And welcome back to Central Standard. We're about to meet a man who strikes up conversations with 100-year-old black men on buses, admits to having phone sex, tricks his deaf mother, and ends up naked in New York for a various number of random reasons. And he concludes, through all of these travails, that perhaps his heart is an idiot. We welcome Davey Rothbart. He's the author of a new collection of autobiographical essays titled My Heart is an Idiot. He's a contributor to This American Life and founder of Found Magazine, which is a publication dedicated to sharing discarded and discovered writings. He's the founder of the Found Magazine. Davey Rothbart, welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks so much. Good to be there.
Why is your heart an idiot?
Well, you know, I think my heart is an idiot in a way that many people's hearts can be idiots, which is that, you know, it's easy sometimes to glimpse a stranger and feel sort of overwhelmingly in love, feel like this person is a soulmate, this is someone I'm going to, you know, be with for the rest of my life, and when you really don't know them too well. And it can be an appealing fantasy, and sometimes it's borne out, you know, but for me, a lot of times it hasn't been. And so, you know, it's what happens when you, I guess the collision between fantasy and reality, when you build something up in your mind, and it doesn't always go the way you'd hoped, but sometimes something else positive comes out of it.
You have several instances in this book where you do build up something in your mind, as you say in your words, to paraphrase your words in the book, something that seems urgent is something else once you get there. And that applies
absolutely.
Right, that applies to you meeting with someone on an airplane or meeting an author over an email exchange, which you do in this book. How do you choose the stories that you pick to tell?
You know, yeah, there was about 40 ideas for stories I had. I wrote, before I wrote the book, My Heart is an Idiot, I made a list of about 40 stories and ended up writing about 5 or 6 of those. And then as I was writing those, new ideas came into my mind. So the book is 16 tales, 16, you know, personal essays. Many of them are about my own misadventures with love and relationships. And then a lot of them, too, are just about interesting strangers I've met over the last 10 years as I've been roaming around the country doing these Found Magazine tours.
Tell us about growing up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and why you mocked and tricked your deaf mother in a story aptly named after LL Cool J's seminal album, Bigger and Deafer. Tell us about that.
Yeah, definitely. I'm glad you caught the reference. My mom is cool. We're very close. My mom is deaf. She can't hear. She's 100% deaf. And so my brothers and I, I've done some of This American Life pieces about her. And we've done, hold on just 1 second.
Someone's knocking on your door.
Yeah, someone's knocking on my door here. It's not my mom. It's I'm talking to you from a hotel in Houston. We would play tricks on her. You know, we would take advantage of her deafness to get away with stuff. You know, and you know, I think any kid will, you know, push the envelope a little bit and find ways to get away with stuff. Well, you know, my mom now she has a operator assisted telephone where you know they can type out on a screen what a person on the other end of the line is saying. But as a kid, she needed me and my brothers to translate for her. And so, you know, when the principal of my school calls and wants me to tell her about something I did to get in trouble at school that day, of course I'm going to cross the wires on my translations just a little bit. And maybe, you know, maybe mouthing off in class is going to turn into, you know, that the principal called to tell her that I saved this pink butterfly from kids on the playground who were going to pull its wings off.
And that's exactly what you did. That's exactly what you did.
Stuff like that. And so what's cool is that my mom, you know, all the time we were playing tricks on her, she actually had her own cards up her sleeve, and she was actually turning the tables on us.
Right. The biggest trick that you played on her was pretending that somebody was at the door, because your dog would run to the door if there was a guest coming to the door. So you would make the dog run to the door, and by virtue of that, your mom would go to the door.
Yeah, there was a little doorbell. It was had been there tucked away in a corner of the house, in the middle of the house. She had never seen this thing, and so we would ring that doorbell, and the dog was trained to, you know, fetch her if someone was at the front door and bring her by her sleeve to the door. So we called it playing ding dong ditch from the comfort of our own house, where we could ring that doorbell, watch the dog bring her to the front door, and she'd look out over the the front porch and see no one was there. My dad would get in on the action. He would play that game too. Of course, we later realized, you know, that she knew it was our game, and she was just pleased by our kind of excitement over playing this game. You know, if any of it sounds cruel, I was talking to a woman yesterday who also had, was raised with a deaf mom, and she said that she felt like the things that we did to my mom were they reminded her of the things that her and her siblings would do to their mom. And you know, we are so close. What's been interesting about this tour? We're going to 79 cities on this tour, and I've gotten to see a lot of the people who are in these stories. You know, they're all true stories, and these characters, they're not characters, they're, you know, they're real people, and I've gotten to run into them at these events. And my mom was at our event in Seattle. She happened to be out there. So she came over on stage and kind of talked about her perspective on that first story, that bigger and deafer story. So it's cool to get her added insight.
I wonder what her insight might be on this next story, perhaps the most controversial, wacky, weird, twisted story. 99 bottles of, I'll let you insert the blank, on the wall. And just to give our audience a primer, it's not beer. It's something else. Tell us about that story.
I can't believe, you know, it's really funny, but I wrote these stories. I should know what's in the book, but they existed. For the last 4 years or 5 years I've been working on this book, these stories were just on my laptop. And I think some part of me forgot that someone else would, other people would actually be reading these one day.
Oh, yeah, on Central Standard, we read the books. So
Yeah, I know. I mean, just and that readers around the country have been reading. My heart is an idiot. I talked to a book club yesterday in Baltimore, and they had just read that story and were asking me about it. 99 bottles of pee on the wall. I'm just saying that the stories are very raw, very intimate. And I guess, here, I'll put it this way, and then I want to talk to you about that story. People have come up to me at our events, and they've this fall, and they've said, you know, I read your book, and they kind of give me this weird look, and I'm like, wow, you know me really well, don't you? And they're like, yeah, I kind of do, because the stories are so personal.
So you're about to explain why people come up to you like that.
Exactly.
Tell us why. Bottles of
pee on the wall. Well, it's about, okay. I always feel like I have to make disclaimers when I talk about some of these stories so that I don't seem completely insane. But the story is about, it was kind of a dark period I had. I had fallen off a roof. I broke my ankle. I had this girl broke up with me. I was totally in love with her. I was really heart sick. And I was laid up in my little attic bedroom in Michigan, and I couldn't get downstairs to pee. I started peeing in bottles, all right? And then I had realized I had you know, sort of amassed this collection of 99 bottles of pee, and it seemed sad, or it seemed like a waste of some potential interesting opportunity to just throw them all away, throw them all out, dump them outside, whatever. So I at the same time, I had been getting these emails from this guy. It seemed, he was running basically these like scams, like sort of taking advantage of aspiring writers. He was running these like kind of dodgy contests where if you send him $75, you might win a prize. He might let you read at some book festival that was kind of, you know, a sham. And I just started getting really angry that this guy was victimized. You know, so many of my friends are aspiring writers, and they're great writers. But it's these kinds of, it was like a phony contest that was taking advantage of people like that. And I just, it was getting to me. So I began to mail these bottles of pee to this guy, and eventually confronted him in person. So that's what the story is about, kind of my own brand of frontier justice, I guess.
Well, it's interesting how you end up confronting him in person, because you actually went to San Francisco and you put your fizzy bottles into his office and left them there in a very stalkerish sort of way. And then you track him down in New York at one of those conferences that he's putting on, which are fake conferences, by the way, where he kind of dupes self-published authors and aspiring writers into coming and sharing their work, and they genuinely want to share their work, and that was a source of your consternation. And so you end up meeting him during an Orlando Magic Lakers finals game by accident, and that's how you end up confronting him. Talk about that.
Well, because I'd gone to both coasts to try to find the guy, and I don't even know what I was expecting. I just wanted to confront the guy in person, and then I couldn't find him. I went to this book festival. He wasn't even there, really. He just left out a bunch of snacks and some name tags, and that was, you know, pretty much what his festival was about. And then I, at the bar that night, in the hotel where the festival was housed, I ran into him. I didn't even realize it was him. We went up to someone's room to watch some NBA Finals action, and we're just talking about life. And then it kind of hit, I realized that it was him. I realized it was the guy I'd been sort of stalking, I guess, for quite a while. And you know, and I'll have to say, like, you know, we found some kind of peace. I think he understood that he kind of, it sank in for the first time that there were real victims of what he was doing. I think, you know, there's a way people can lie to themselves for so long that they kind of believe in it, you know, and I think he had somehow sold it to himself that what he was doing wasn't harming anybody, but I think it did kind of begin to soak in once I was there in person.
Soak in.
Confronting him.
soak in, literally.
So to speak. The stories in My Heart is an Idiot, I think, you know, many of them are about these kind of, you know, misadventures and love and relationships, but a lot of them are about just interesting people I've met on the road, you know, in the last 10 years traveling around the country. That there was a guy, I was on my way to the Grand Canyon, and I saw this hitchhiker, you know, standing by the side of the road, this old guy, probably 70, 75, and I picked him up. He told me his story. He was from Boston, and he worked in a factory his whole life, and his lifelong dream was to visit the Grand Canyon. So he told me that a few weeks before at work, the guys he worked with, they were like, you know, shut up, man. You're always talking about the Grand Canyon. You're never going to get there. It's depressing to hear you talk about it. Just shut up. And he kind of looks to them, and he says, I quit. And he turned in his tools, walked out, and had got a bus ticket a few weeks later, headed west. And so here's a guy whose lifelong dream is to go to the Grand Canyon. I'm lucky enough to be the one to pick him up, you know, his last 2 hours before he reaches the canyon, to, you know, deliver him to the edge of the canyon and be there to witness that moment as he kind of looks out across the Grand Canyon for the first time and thrust his fist in the air. And we ended up camping out together that weekend, and, you know, he was kind of an inspiring guy. And so I feel like whenever I engage with a stranger, I'm always rewarded. And that story is in the book, My Heart is an Idiot, the story about this guy, John Malloy. And I think there's other stories like that where it's kind of maybe I launched myself on an adventure for one thing, probably to try to win some girl's heart over, but maybe something else came out of it. Maybe I made some other connections with strangers that ended up being meaningful to me in some way.
Life happens that way, definitely. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is David Rothbard. He's the author of a new collection of autobiographical essays titled My Heart is an Idiot. He's also a frequent contributor to This American Life and the founder of Found Magazine. Speaking of This American Life, what would you say is the difference between storytelling in print versus the work you do with This American Life and your documentary work and your magazine work? What's the difference in nuances
definitely.
Of storytelling?
Well, I love personal storytelling in all forms, and that's, you know, a lot of my favorite books are personal essays. I was a fan of This American Life before I ever started working for the show and doing stories for the show, because I love the intimacy of radio. I love hearing, you know, people's voices. I think it's hard to make a distinction almost between, you know, the some of the stories I've done for This American Life, where, for example, the first story I did for the show was when I went to visit Mr. Rogers. I interviewed my neighbors in Chicago about the conflicts they were having with each other, and then I played the tapes for Mr. Rogers and let him, like, mediate their disputes. And it was funny because, you know, he had all the puppets out from the Land of Make-Believe, X the Owl, you know, King Friday. They're all putting in their own two cents. And you know, he was an amazing guy. There's stories about my mom. You know, she's in that story, Bigger and Deafer, in the book. But I've done some This American Life pieces with her. We went. She's deaf, as I mentioned. So we went to Brazil to visit this miracle healer, to this guy named John of God, to see if we could get her hearing back. And there's people there from all over the country, from all over the world, people with, you know, cancer, with AIDS, people in wheelchairs, all seeking healing. We were down there for a month, so that was a really intense trip. So I don't know. I like personal storytelling. I like exploring different mediums. Found Magazine, you know, is I think there's a connection between Found Magazine and the My Heart is an Idiot book, because these notes and letters that people find on the ground and send to us, you know, love letters, to-do lists, journal entries, the kinds of stuff we put in the magazine, each one gives you a glimpse into someone else's life. And it's up to you to kind of fill in the blanks. It sparks your imagination. You know, who is this person? What's their story? But I think in My Heart is an Idiot, it's kind of like taking it one step further and being like, hey, these are real people that I met on the road. road, you know, someone that picked me up hitchhiking, you know, I ran out of gas, or someone sitting next to me on a Greyhound bus, you know, getting to find out their actual stories. You know, they're the kinds of people who might have been the authors of found notes, and you might just wonder who they are. Now, you know, when you talk to someone next to you on the next bar stool or next to you on the bus, you get a chance to hear their real stories, and that's some of what I tried to share in the book. And also Saturday night, you know, we're going to be doing this event here in Kansas City. At the Record Bar, we do this kind of a live, rowdy, energetic reading and music show. And I read a bunch of my favorite found notes that people have sent in over the years. My brother Peter plays songs based on the found notes that are really incredible, and he's just a great musician. I also am going to share stories from My Heart as an Idiot, a couple from the new book, and then we'll do some stuff that involves the crowd. I won't give it away, but it's Saturday night at the Record Bar, 7 p.m. It's going to be a really, really special night, so we hope people come down and join us.
And we'll talk a little bit later about you're sort of a fan of Westport. You actually mentioned it in the book, but right now we're going to talk about Psychic Buddha Qu'est-ce que c'est, your piece for This American Life. Tell us, who is Aaron?
Yeah. Aaron, it's cool that you brought it up. Aaron is a spirit that my mom channels, a 2,000-year-old spirit. My mom is a meditation teacher, and she's a channeler. So, you know, we were teenagers, and she kind of announced that there was this guy Aaron that she could communicate with, and she's been channeling him now for about 20 years. And you know, I was skeptical at first. You know, who, you know, what, it seemed crazy. You know, and you know, my mom's talking to ghosts, but my mom is so grounded and so completely rational and sane that it, you know, I took her word for it, and I've seen Aaron bring a lot of good things into people's lives over the years. You know, it was like people began to call my mom from all over the country, and because she's deaf, I would be helping her with these phone calls, and they would, you know, this one guy I remember in Minnesota, his teenage daughter had run away, and Aaron wasn't just saying, you know, oh, here's where she is, go find her.
David,
he was more talking. Yes,
we're actually going to let our audience hear a snippet of Psychic Buddha Qu'est-ce que c'est from your piece in This American Life, and then we'll come back. Let's hear that right now.
That sounds great.
Of everyone in the family, Mike has turned to Aaron the most. In his freshman year of college, Mike basically had a breakdown. What happened was he started dealing with the fact that he'd got molested by a neighbor when he was little. The emotional weight of that started tearing him apart. He couldn't function.
At first, I felt like I was sinking, like in a pit, just sinking further and further, getting depressed, not doing much of anything. And then, I don't know, I just basically, eventually it just got so bad that I just called Mom and asked her for help, and she said, I'll put Aaron on the line.
Right. What can Aaron say that after what you went, some dude, like, touched you improperly, and, I mean, that seems pretty f***ed up. What can Aaron say to make that better or go away? He can't, like, take it back. He can't. I wish Aaron was more like the punitive type of spirit. And like, if you said some dude like improperly touched me, and he would just like put like a bolt of lightning and like, you know, we read about it in the paper the next day. Then I'd be like, yeah.
Right. But basically, when I would call, I'd explain how I was doing, and Aaron would just really help me to see things from a more universal perspective. Like, here I was, you know.
Like, your problems aren't really that big, or, like?
More that my problems were temporary.
I remember when Mike would call from school to talk to my mom and Aaron. She didn't have a deaf telephone back then, so Mike could talk to me, and I'd translate into sign language for my mom. And I remember there'd be long stretches where I'd just do the sign for crying, running my finger down my cheek, again and again. Over the past 12 years, I've watched my mom and Aaron help literally thousands of people. Folks come to them in so much pain and seem to leave feeling so much calmer. I've always felt really proud of my mom for all the work she's done to help people through their darkest times.
That was Psychic Buddha Qu'est-ce que c'est, a piece by our guest, Davey Rothbard, a contributor to This American Life and also the author of a collection of autobiographical essays titled My Heart is an Idiot, that we've been discussing here today on Central Standard. More broadly, Davey Rothbard, your work across all media seems to be about the things you find, whether tangible or abstract, while traveling. And It reveals something about yourself. Tell us about that process and how it informs your work and your ability to share what is a lot of times too much information. We seem to have lost Davey Rothbert. Maybe he's in his Houston hotel room on the phone. I thought maybe somebody had came to your door and snatched you. And
took me away. No, I'm here. I find that, you know, every day is kind of, you know, adventure kind of awaits, and you never really know what to expect. And when you open yourself to the world around you, you know, it could be, well, for example, you know, I made a connection with a guy in Kansas City. He had been sending us notes for File Magazine over the years, a guy named Byron Case. And one of the pieces in the new book is about Byron. It's called The Strongest Man in the World. And Byron, as it turns out, you know, he was a Kansas City kid. He would hang out in Westport, kind of into goth music, and, you know, went to high school in Kansas City. And later he was found guilty of a murder that I believe he did not commit and that, you know, he's always claimed to be innocent of. And so he's locked up right now at Crossroads Correctional Facility in Cameron, Missouri, serving a life sentence. And so the story in the book is about Byron Case and about me getting to know him and getting to understand the details of his case and, you know, coming to believe in his innocence. And so, you know, I visited Kansas City many times, and I visited him at Crossroads Correctional Facility. I'll see him this Sunday after our show at Record Bar Saturday night. I'll go up Sunday morning and get to hang out with Byron. But I believe that he shouldn't be locked up, and this story is kind of explains, you know, how it came to be that an innocent man could go to prison for life.
You've been here several times on several of your book tours. What's your impression of Kansas City as a storyteller, essentially living this American life, so to speak?
Yeah. I really like Kansas City. You know, I've had really great friends there. It's a cool city. Honestly, I really like mid-sized American cities almost more, you know, Kansas City, Pittsburgh, St. Louis, you know, towns of that size are kind of my favorite. And it's been interesting to see Kansas City over 10 years, see it grow. There's cool bars. There's a really vibrant artistic scene, it seems to me. We have great events. And you know, my friend Cato lives in Kansas City, and he's shown me some of the great spots around town. And you know, for me, because Byron is such a good friend, and there's always a slight little heaviness in my heart, honestly, when I come to Kansas City, because I always go up to see him in prison, and you know, and it's sad to see someone who I feel shouldn't be locked up, you know, but the city itself is cool. What do you think? How long are you from there? Are you a native? How long have you been there?
I'm not allowed to say my personal views on the air there, David Eckert,
Kansas City.
But I've been here about 3 years. I love it.
Okay.
You name that story about your friend Byron here in Kansas City, The Strongest Man. Why did you name it that?
Well, it was the name of a band that you know appears in the story. But also it's a quote from a Ibsen play. The strongest man in the world is he who walks alone. And Byron, you know, Byron has been walking alone in a way. You know, he's living in this kind of Kafkaesque nightmare. I don't mean to get overly political or you know, to bring up this. It's one of the most kind of intense and sadder stories in the book, I think. But there's a website, freebyroncase.com. If anyone wants to learn more about his situation, they can check out freebyroncase.com. And, you know, Byron's walking alone, but he has the support of a lot of friends and family that, you know, believe in him. So
the Record Bar, you mentioned Westport a lot in your book, and the Record Bar is sort of in the heart of the Westport area. So
yeah.
Talk about some of your experiences in Westport.
Yeah, in fact, it's funny because the Record Bar appears in the book, and that's where our event is on Saturday night, 7 o'clock.
Was that your plan?
No, it's weird. just thinking about it, I didn't even realize that that I'll be reading at Record Bar, and that's where, it actually takes. You know, I'll be reading that story. And it takes place there. Westport's cool, you know. I like that when cities have these neighborhoods. You know, it was one of the first places you know, friends took me to when I came to Kansas City for the first time. And you know, Denver, I feel like has a Westport type neighborhood. You know, Portland, Oregon. All of Portland, Oregon is Westport. but it's always cool to see. You know, there's cool bookstores, there's cool cafes, cool bars, and you know, to know there's a place like Record Bar, who's hosted us a couple times over the years. You know, that are doing good stuff. So.
Our guest is Davey Rothbard. He's the author of a new collection of autobiographical essays titled My Heart is an Idiot. He's a frequent contributor to This American Life and founder of Found Magazine. He will be at the Record Bar in his beloved Westport this Saturday at 7 p.m. telling some stories from the book My Heart is an Idiot, doing some musical performances, and genuinely showing us his idiotic heart. Thank you very much, David Rothbard, for joining us here on Central Standard.
Oh, it was great talking to you this morning.
You can listen to our podcast, archive shows, and a lot more at kcur.org. And tune in tomorrow as the food critics dive deep into Kansas City fish. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, executive produced by Bill Anderson. Kim Noble is our announcer. Emily Mutert manages our website. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney, and the outro that you're hearing right now is composed by the Will Knotts. Up to Date is next with a chat about merging our minds with digital brains. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.